From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on election night in 2016. What were you doing on election night 2016? Well, a college professor was at home watching the election results, and she told the New York Times in 2018, quote, "As it was getting a little less propitious, I poured another glass of wine, and around 11 o'clock I picked up the whole damn bottle and drank it straight," end quote. The now former professor is current Democratic congressional candidate Tracy Matrano. She told the New York Times that story to explain why she, a cybersecurity expert, a teacher, and a mother, made the jump into politics. Matrano challenged Republican incumbent Tom Reed in 2018 and lost by roughly 8 points. That district is described as ruby red and went for Trump by 15 points in 2016. This year, Matrano is challenging Reed to a rematch, and she told the Cornell Sun in August that she's feeling better about her chances this time. This hour, Matrano joins us to discuss her platform and priorities for the district. We invited Representative Reed to join the conversation as well, but our invitations were not returned. He has been a guest on this program a number of times in the past, including this year and including during the pandemic during the pandemic. And we will offer him equal time this election season. We do hope to have that conversation. But our discussion today is with his opponent, who's here to answer our questions and yours. Tracy Matrano, welcome back to Connections.
Thank you, Evan. It's a delight to be here and on public radio in my hometown.
Yeah, your hometown. Where did you grow up?
I grew up over on Inglewood Drive, which is off 19th Ward, off Genesee Park Boulevard, Chilai Avenue area. I went to St. Augustine's, which I know is now decommissioned, and Nazareth Academy. And then I had the great privilege of going to the University of Rochester.
What was your path to the Finger Lakes?
Well, I fell in love with the study of history, and so I went down to Binghamton University, where I earned a doctorate in American history with an emphasis on women's history, which was new at that time in the early 80s. But I always wanted to be a university or college administrator, so I had equally in mind a path to law school, which I achieved after earning the doctorate, and then teaching in the area. I taught at UB, Keokuk College, and then I went to Cornell Law School, taught at Cornell for a while, and then mostly devoted my career, certainly in the last 20 years, to information, internet, and cybersecurity policy.
It was, certainly a shock to many progressives in 2016, and that story that you told the New York Times is one that I think a lot of people might be able to relate to. What was it, though, that made you convinced, okay, I'm going to run for office and I'm going to run for Congress?
Right. Well, democracy and citizenship have been central to everything I've done. Probably some of your listeners are saying, wait a minute, American historian, cyber, you know, how does that all come together? Well, citizenship, democracy, caring about our communities, caring about our political culture is a common thread. In particular, because of the work that I did in the area of cybersecurity, I became very concerned about our national security when the president politicized the Russian interference in our elections. In spring of 2017, I was watching the NewsHour, and I thought, oh my gosh, isn't someone going to help with this? Maybe I'll call my congressman and see if I could offer a thought. And it occurred to me simultaneously that it is the same congressman who makes fun of where I raised my two children, where I got a good education at Cornell, where my father, who never graduated from high school, and my mother, who was a barmaid, could be very proud of their daughter. But Mr. Reed has consistently, and he is continuing, notwithstanding a promise to stop, ridiculing and making fun of Ithaca. And I knew in that very second he wouldn't care if I called or not. And it was almost just like a next thought, which is, well, gosh, maybe I'll run myself. So it all began pretty much in the spring of 2017.
Okay. And, you know, as much as we talk about how you felt on election night in 2016 and how those who voted for you could relate to that, there's an argument that just based on the numbers in your district, Donald Trump winning your congressional district by 15 points 4 years ago, there's an argument that says your response is out of touch with the district at large. How do you see that?
Well, I don't see that as accurate. I wouldn't call this a ruby red district. It leans Republican. But in 2008, we elected a Democrat, Eric Massa at that time. And it was under circumstances, Evan, that are very similar to the ones that we have now. A presidential race, which brings Democrats out. The country appears to be moving in the direction of the Democratic nominee. By the way, that 15-point was Mr. Trump's high-level mark in this district. He has gone as low as level with Mr. Biden. I think right after the convention, he was up by a few points. I imagine after the performance last week and the news about his illness, it probably, because we track a lot of how Pennsylvania is going in this area, that Biden is probably up. But the main point about the 2008 election, looking a lot like this one, is you had a candidate who was willing to run twice. And the 23rd district went up into the eastern part of Monroe County, up around Fairport and so forth. So people may even remember that election. And Eric Massa won it, and I expect to win this one. When I got into the race in 2017, I predicted on August 22nd publicly it was going to take two times to get Mr. Reed out. So none of this has been surprising. We are absolutely on path to success in terms of our fundraising, in terms of our polling, in terms of how we see Reed reacting or not reacting. He's barely campaigning. Just relies on the corporate money for his advertisements, which, of course, we can't compete with the corporate money. But through our supporters, we raise enough to get the word out. And we have all the polling we need to see that when people see they have a good choice for this campaign in me, they're willing to switch over and vote for me. So we're feeling very strong as we're going into these last 3 weeks.
Talking to Tracy Matrano, the Democratic candidate for the 23rd Congressional District seat, she's challenging incumbent Republican Tom Reed, who has held that seat in this past decade. And you know, I don't spend a whole lot of time in when I talk about political races talking about can you win, you know, who's likely to win. We don't really do that a lot. The reason that I'm pressing the point this time around is just because, you know, you ran 2 years ago, and I find it very interesting, you know, what motivates people to run and how they see either the state of the race, but or also how they see the electorate changing. And so, Tracy, when we look at voter registration, we know this country has gerrymandering issues. We know this country has congressional districts all across the country that have been divvied up in sort of political backroom deals, and they've been strangely shaped. They are weighted by the rolls to benefit one party or another. In 2018, there was what, a 25,000 registration advantage on the Republican side in your district? What is it now?
Well, it hasn't shifted all that much. And in terms of the ruby red, just to really clarify, you may be thinking of the 27th congressional district, the one that our lieutenant governor now, Kathy Hochul, did win once, but then Chris Collins won. And Nate McMurray is running against Mr. Jacobs now. That is a ruby red. It really is very, very heavily Republican favored. This district really isn't that much. So when you've got 300,000 plus people voting and you've got 20,000 more Republicans than Democrats, the wild card, Evan, is 23% or over 90,000 of those 300,000 voters are unaffiliated by mm-hmm. party. That's why it's a swing district. It is not ruby red.
Okay,
I like that phrase, though. I'm going to start using it.
That's fair. All right. Fair enough. And I take that point. And there are plenty of districts that have much more lopsided voter registration rolls. That's true. That is true. So now let's talk about what's going to motivate people to vote this time, because they, you know, for a challenger in a district like yours, given that you've run before, voters are more likely to know who you are this time around. But for those who do not, why don't you reintroduce yourself and let's talk about your work preceding, a little bit about the work that you think, at least the expertise that you've gained in your career that you think can help you in Congress.
Sure. I did grow up modestly. My father ran Matrano's Restaurant downtown. For any listeners who go back in time, I happen to hear that the Hyatt is closing down. And my goodness, I remember construction on that because my dad's restaurant and where I worked from when I was 13 until 19 was, you know, right across the street on South Avenue. It would have been located in the space between the NYSEG building and the convention center on South Avenue. So much of my life in and around Rochester was built around my experience working for my dad, seeing how hard he worked, meeting such a wide range of people. We had people who lived in single occupancy housing come in the morning, and we took care, you know, to make sure they had a breakfast and so forth. And at lunch, the full panoply, shoppers downtown, judges, lawyers. We had the bankers from Lincoln and the librarians just down the street. It was a wonderful experience for me. I have been blessed with a lot of formal education since, but my best education happened at 5961 South Avenue back in the 70s. It's great, I think, to have a background in education, because right now what people crave the most, voters, constituents, people in this country, is better understanding. There are so many reasons why we have this terrible partisan divide that we must overcome, and my campaign is for overcoming it. Our motto is unity for a change. And I think it serves us right now to have someone whose background is in education, because the translation of what a policy issue is on healthcare or broadband or education or infrastructure to how people can really understand where their interests lie, and then how they want their representative to vote. Because repeatedly, we see polling that shows the public, for example, did not want the 2017 Tax Cut Act, but it got passed, and it's had ramifications from the skyrocketing deficit all the way to the undermining of Social Security and Medicare, which I can tell you, Republican and Democrat across the board and unaffiliated care very, very much about the integrity of those programs, especially as they age and rely on them. There are any number of other areas in which it's really important, and I watch the expression on people's face. I talk to them. They're trying to understand, how did we get here? How did things get so divided? Why is everything so bitter? How can we get over it? What are these laws really about, and what impact will they have on me? So having someone who comes from a background in education, I think, is a big plus right now. And for people who have been left behind, as the people in this district have for the last 10 years, they're desperate to know it. It's life and death. Some of the counties came up red hot on the heat map that the New York Times did about what counties in New York State are most at risk for when the epidemic would hit. We have some of the largest numbers of people now laid off, unemployed, with no new manufacturing coming in to take the place of a Dresser Rand or a Cummings or, you know, many of the other places that we've had here for quite some time, but are now going out of business. We don't have broadband in 30% of the people, and then don't have a connection. Kids who were sent home in March fell off the educational map because they didn't have anything to connect to. The schools provided them, and I want to be clear about this. They provided them with device. They provided them with a hotspot. There's nothing to connect to when they get to their house. That keeps their parents behind from working at home. That keeps parents who have been laid off and are looking to inform themselves and educate themselves with certificates so they can get back into the workforce. They're not able to do it. And there's no public transportation. If the default is, well, you can go to the library. Very rural areas, quite different than Rochester, in my experience, in an expanded or urban area where you not only have the city of Rochester, but you have a ring of suburbs around it that act as a large metropolitan area. This area, yes, we have significant cities, Ithaca, Corning, Jamestown, Dunkirk, Geneva, so forth, but we do not have the automatic amenities that you think of, for example, in public transportation or a neighborhood library for so many of our rural people. I also could talk a long time about the crisis in agriculture, and in this case, I am sorry, our representative has done nothing for the hundreds of people who have gone out of business, especially in dairy. Last year, we had 11 suicides. People who are committing suicide and leaving a note, and this is a real case, saying, and this was a man in his early 40s, I'm sorry, I sold the herd this morning. It still doesn't cover our debts. I have a life insurance policy through the Farm Bureau. I hope that helps. He left 5 children and a 16-year-old boy who found him in the barn. This is the kind of situation we have down here, the negligence we've had from this representative, the failure to do his job. And that's why it matters so much to have someone who is willing to go out there, willing to talk with people, willing to educate people, willing to spend time to understand what it means of this bill in government or that bill and how it's going to affect their lives.
All right, so a couple of points on that. As we talked to Tracy Matrano, the Democratic candidate for the 23rd Congressional District seat, she's challenging Tom Reed, a Republican who is invited to join us for his own conversation on this program before the election, and we hope we can make that happen. Listeners, you can join the conversation with questions or comments yourself if you like. 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Now, your opponent would like voters to think of you as a radical liberal. That's the term he used. And I know that you told the Cornell Sun and others that you dispute that label, on not just sort of, you know, label and name-calling grounds, but also on the grounds of substantive policy. And one of the examples is health care. Where do you differ with most national Democrats on health care?
Well, I will say that in one moment. Let me say this is right out of the Republican playbook. If you hear, and we do hear, Mr. Trump talking about the far left and talking about the socialism that Biden represents and so on and so forth. This is playbook. And Mr. Reid has done this with every single one of his opponents, no matter who they are. You know, the joke about Mr. Plum, who ran in 2016, was that he, too, was an extreme ethical liberal. And when asked, how can someone from Jamestown be that? He said, well, that's where the money comes from. This is just what he does. He creates a straw man, and then he spends $3 million attacking the straw man and not really willing to talk about the issues or the policies themselves. And why? Because he's done nothing for us, and he is dodging the accountability that he has to the people in this district. On healthcare, it's a great example. Tom Reed has voted against every single bill that has come across his desk that has anything to do with advancing affordability of healthcare or prescription drugs for the people of the United States. Every single one. And for your listeners, if they don't know, Tom Reed's business before he got into politics was medical debt collection. And he has been cited by the Ethics Committee in the House for a conflict of interest on exactly that point. My health care position is we have to be moving towards affordable, available, and efficient health care in this country. What are some of the specific points? I agree with Mr. Biden that we should start bringing Medicare eligibility down to age 60 and lower as we move forward. We must lower prescription drug costs. We need generic pricing for common needs such as insulin and EpiPens and inhalers. But number one, Evan, and I am sure I will find colleagues on day one when I get there in January who will join me in this. Let's have just a bill that says no discrimination on the basis of a pre-existing condition, period. Let's not bundle it up with a health care plan that is ripe for an attack from the Republicans who want to malign it because of the contributions they get from the health care industry to keep their profits rolling. Let's just have a bill that makes that one absolutely loud and clear. But those are some of the things that we need to start working on. The pieces of stuff that people care the most about: pre-existing conditions, lower prescription drug costs, and eligibility for Medicare down, you know, to a degree so that we can begin to have universal health care, which is how we will make health care in this country more efficient.
Okay, but what's the basis for your opposition to Medicare for All that many of your Democratic colleagues support?
Oh, gosh, how long do we have to go over that old trodden ground? First of all, it's become a rabbit hole that Republicans use to shove Democrats down, and I'm not going there. Secondly, I'll say it loud and clear. I do not think that one single payer program is consistent with the culture and tradition of the United States. If anyone wants my opinion about what would be on an international basis, it's the kind of healthcare program that is in Germany that is universal, but it also has a variety of private insurance as well as public options and availability. I just don't think a single payer program is ever going to be passed in the United States. I am not sure it rings my bell of efficient because of its costs. And I do not think the people of this country are going to accept it. We know very clearly the Democrats didn't accept it as their position. So, Evan, it's time to move on from that. Let's talk about the practical things that we can do for people in healthcare instead of allowing the Republicans to set the straw man up and keep poking at it. Let's get people protection for pre-existing conditions. Let's not have another death as we had here in Chemung County of a young man, 26 years old, who got off of his parents' insurance because of age. He didn't want to tell them that he was running out of money. He began to half his insulin, and his parents found him in a coma from which he died. There's no reason in the United States that anyone should be dying for the lack of insulin, which can be made for pennies and should be sold for that or even less. These are the kinds of real issues that people care about. I think most people done and finished with those theoretical debates. Let's help real people with real health problems in the United States.
Talking to Tracy Matrano, who also is a gun owner, I understand. You're a gun owner?
Yes, sir.
What do you own?
I own a couple of shotguns and an antiquated pistol that I believe was probably my grandfather, Giuseppe Matrano, who lived over on Avery Street off of Lyle Avenue.
Okay. And how do you feel about the way the question of guns has either divided or united certain districts like your own?
Well, again, there's a lot of purposeful lying about people's position.
Lying?
Yeah, I was going to try to make it nicer. But the fact of the matter is that I don't know of a single Democrat, and I can certainly just speak for myself. No Democrat, by virtue of being on a Democratic line, is going to come and take your guns away. That is a lie. That certainly isn't my position, but it is a line that I hear in almost every single county in this district when I go talk to Second Amendment enthusiasts. It's the first thing that gets said. I can share with you, Evan, by the time I leave these organizations, I feel like, A, I've been hanging around with my dad and his friends. B, I grew up with the NRA magazines and ammo and everything else on the little table in the bathroom along with Reader's Digest. It was part and parcel of how I grew up during the riots in Rochester in the 1960s. My dad went up to the attic and brought his guns down. So I am very familiar with guns. We did have kind of a traditional gender thing in my family. So no, I didn't go out and hunt like my cousins, my boy cousins. But I know how to shoot a gun. And if the next question is, so then what is your policy on it? Why don't I just jump to that? I do believe that Congress covers too large of a body for us to get into specifics about gun safety measures. A law that might fit New York City is not going to fit Alaska, for example, or even Cattaraugus or Chautauqua or Allegheny or any county in this district. There's a lot of hunting. My dad used to come down and shoot deer over in Cattaraugus. He shoot ducks over in Steuben County on the Cohocton River. There's a lot of hunting down here, and we absolutely want to preserve the rights and abilities for people to be able to hunt safely, to be able to do sportsmanship. I've been to many a range now and shoot. My goodness, my stepson, I've got two stepsons who are deputy sheriffs in one of the counties in this district. And for Mother's Day, one time they said, well, if you buy the ammunition, let's go shooting. So I have shot every kind of a gun, from an old-fashioned pistol right up to, you know, some of the ones that are talked about frequently today, the semi-automatic so-called assault rifles. I believe Congress should repeal the law that gave gun manufacturers and gun sellers immunity from civil suits. I don't believe any industry should have that immunity. That is an example of the kind of lobbying that hurts this country, that has perverted Congress, and actually, to me, is just as un-American as the kind of rights that Second Amendment enthusiasts want preserved out of the Constitution, to be able to go to court if you believe you have been harmed and you have a case. Now, often people will say, what about frivolous suits? The answer is civil procedural laws knock those cases out. And then the next thing people frequently say, Evan, is, well, if you take a car and drive someone over. Is it the car's fault? No, and that would be a frivolous suit. And that is why the automobile industry does not have automatic immunity, as the gun manufacturer has ginned up in Congress. So the one change I would make is let's get rid of that law. It's not appropriate for any industry to have an automatic get out of civil suit card in their back pocket.
Coming up, we're going to turn over the questions to our listeners. I want to ask you briefly, though, if you would have voted for the pandemic relief bills that Congress has voted for. And let's go back to the beginning of the pandemic. Congress passes a $3 trillion plus, I think they called it the CARES Act at the time. Would you have voted for that bill?
I would have, but I would have opened my mouth to say it was structured upside down. And what do I mean by that? Half a trillion dollars went out the door to banks, big corporations, and special interests before we even got around to helping the people who really needed it. And then Congress came around 6 weeks later and said, taxpayers, we need a little more money for the small business people. And we gave it to them out of the generosity of our heart, out of the desire to get this country moving again and economically viable while we're going through this pandemic. You bet I would have voted for it, but I would have spoken out and I would have fought to have gotten those special interest provisions out, you know, about half a trillion dollars. For people who have ever taken a Psych 101 course, you learn something called Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you understand that people have to begin with safety and health, public safety and health. That's where the money should have gone first. For the people who were affected by the virus, for the hospitals, and for research. And then you move up the scale to food and shelter and safety for people who were immediately suffering and affected by it. Then you help schools reopen, and you help municipalities that are looking at bankruptcy because the sales tax isn't there, which is a big revenue driver for them to maintain our roads and functions and so forth. Then you can move up to the unemployed. Then you can move up to small business. And then you can move up the stack, but that stack should be very narrow at the top instead of having given a huge chunk of that CARES Act to the corporations, banks, and special interests that did not need it. That is welfare for the corporations, and I don't think welfare is in the playbook for corporations.
Well, when
they've already got their tax break.
Last spring, when your opponent was on this program, he was getting ready to go to Washington to urge his colleagues to vote for the second round, more money for SBA loans, et cetera. He said it was a priority, had to get done. He was going to urge it to pass as quickly as possible. I pointed out that, number one, a lot of small businesses at the time were having trouble getting access to those loans because they didn't have lawyers and relationships with banks to sort of power them through the line. The first round ran out when the Shake Shacks and the Los Angeles Lakers were getting small business loans, and a lot of actual small businesses weren't. He responded by telling me that it wasn't ideal, but it really was Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's fault, but we had to do something over nothing. And he said Democrats in Congress were largely to blame for the problems with an imperfect set of bills. Was your party to blame for that?
Well, would you expect Tom Reed, who talks up a big political theater about being bipartisan and then constantly is on the attack? Would you believe a Tom Reed who all he can do is talk about state issues and argue against Cuomo even when we're in the middle of a pandemic instead of trying to be genuinely bipartisan in a time when the country needs it the most? Would you expect Tom Reed to ever take responsibility for anything? I don't, Evan. So that is part of what I expect Tom Reed to say every time. Look, I'm not a cookie cutter Democrat. I'm going to go to Congress to represent the people of the 23rd district. And if it means that I have to say, and I'll give you an example, hey, Democrats, how come you haven't stood up for people who want to go to school and now have interest rates on their educational loans at 8, 10, 12%. Why haven't you stood up? Are you too close to the banks? Are you getting too much corporate PAC money to say nothing about these outrageous interest rates that keep people in debt for 2 and 3 decades of their life? I'll say it straight away. You know, I was understood at Cornell to be someone who got the job done. I got results. And I have been yelled and screamed at by the best of them. But I did what I could for the university in the role that I did that actually became a national mark for internet policy in higher education. And I did it because I kept my eye on the ball. I worked for the effectiveness and the efficiency of that university, including its medical campus in New York and everything else. That's exactly what I'm going to do when I go to Washington. And if I have to stand up to Nancy Pelosi or President Biden or anybody else and say enough is enough with those interest rates, and I'm just giving you one example, then I will stand up and say it. I am too old now to be cowered by anybody. I've already made my career mark. I left a job that pays more than Congress to run for this office because I actually do believe that the people of this district and this country deserve better than Tom Reed and President Trump.
Last question then on pandemic response. What should Congress do next for the American people?
I'm sorry, I was distracted for 1 second. What should Congress do next?
In regards to the pandemic, for people who are hurting, for small businesses, et cetera, there's debate in Washington over what the next proper steps are, either for relief or help. What should Congress do?
Yes. All right, thank you. I was distracted. You know, we're all at home nowadays, and people come by. And
indeed.
So forth, yes. Yeah, so I apologize. We need more research, Evan. I've been asked many times, should we give $600 to the unemployed? And I watch the news hour, and there's someone on there that says, well, hell, give me that $600, and I don't have to go to work anymore. And then there's the other person that says, I still can't make ends meet, even if you give me the $600. We need more research, and we've got all the brain power in this country to do it. And that research can tell us who needs it and who doesn't. Let's help the people who need it. And let's use the intelligence and the capabilities we have, both in government as well as in higher education or add on corporate research as well. We can get to a better place. I am afraid we all have allowed Congress and our representatives to do a lot of political theater, fighting back and forth, calling each other names, blaming each other all the time for why they're not getting anything done. No wonder national polling shows the confidence in Congress around this country hovers around 12%. We can do better than that. So I plan to go there and be a voice of change in that direction and not playing on the political swing.
Okay, but that feels a little bit like a dodge in that you're saying you want more research. You're not telling me whether you'd vote for an extension of $600 in terms of that benefit, or I don't know if a UBI or anything else that's on your radar. More research takes time. Congress needs to probably make a decision in short order on this, right?
I want money to go out to people who need it. And so I'll go back to the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We still need money in public health research and for hospitals. People have been affected by it. Do you know 1 in 4 children go to bed hungry in this district? 1 in 5 adults? We need food. We need shelter. We needed to be more careful when we're opening schools. And I think if you talk with our friends over in Buffalo, they can second that motion. But it's true in a lot of schools right here in this district. We need to help our municipalities. Do you know when the line from recession to depression occurred in the 1930s? When our municipalities went bankrupt. If we let ourselves go down that far, we are making a terrible mistake. And boy, there's something that Tom Reed took a long time to finally get the memo on because he wanted to make it a fight with Cuomo. I don't care who, when, and where, and how, although I do. But my point is we've got to get the money out to the municipalities to be sure that they do not go bankrupt. We need to help the unemployed. We need to help small business. And we need to keep our economy afloat. And the way you do that in an economic downturn is push money into the economy. I am behind that 100%. My point is, I hear too much political rhetoric and blame gaming back and forth. I am calling for the intelligence in this country to focus on getting right where, when, and how giving money, infusing it into our economy is going to help us the most.
Talking to Tracy Matrano, who is challenging Tom Reed for a seat in Congress for a second time. 2 years ago, Representative Reed won that election by about 8 points. This time around, we've invited both candidates. We've got Tracy Matrano today. We hope to have Tom Reed before the election. After our only break of the hour, your phone calls with Tracy Matrano. Coming up in our second hour, the authors of a new book on pandemics join us. The book is called Viral Pandemics, From Smallpox to COVID-19. And the authors explore the history of viral biology, what we know about it, how we tracked it, how vaccines developed, and how global interconnectedness contributes to worldwide pandemics. And yes, We look at how those lessons are being applied, successfully or not, to COVID. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Hal and Waylon first with Tracy Matrano. Go ahead, Hal.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you, Tracy Matrano, for being so persistent and running in our 23rd Congressional District. I've heard you speak in public as well as Congressman Tom Reed for some time, and I have to agree with you that he tends to be very polarizing and dismissive, blaming everyone except finding solutions. So I very much agree with that point you've made, as well as the importance of agriculture. I just recently sold a small amount of produce to Abundance Market on South Avenue in Rochester, but small farms have been made historic almost because of the economies of scale that has taken over agriculture, where prices have not really changed in many years. So recognizing the importance of small farms in the 23rd Congressional District and actually supporting them would be very helpful. And related to that, this year, our farm and other bigger potato farmers around here, I understand, have lost perhaps 30% due to a very droughty year. And it's not just our drought, but it's a global climate change that I'm referring to. The fires in the West are just symptomatic of a changing world, and it is a crisis that, as far as I can tell, Tom Reed and the current administration ignores. And finally, the Sierra Club, which has about 3.8 million members in the U.S., has a local Finger Lakes group that I've been part of leading for the last few years. And we got information from both campaigns, and after considering it, we locally endorsed Tracy Matrano for Congresswoman in the 23rd District, and that went on to the state, where there's a much larger nationally, with almost 20 million people. We have many members in New York State. Endorsement of Tracy Matrano, and finally to the national organization based in Oakland. So the Sierra Club has chosen to endorse Tracy Matrano, and I obviously am supportive and wish her very well.
Do you have a question for her, Hal? We got to get moving here.
Okay. So what would you do to support small farms in the Finger Lakes so that this financialization and economies of scale don't continue to put so many small farms out of business? As in the first Great Depression, about one-third of Americans lived on farms. Now it's less than 2%. And okay. I'll wait for your answer.
All right, Hal, thank you. Go ahead, Tracy.
Thank you, Hal. So well said about the problems and challenges that the small farmers face in this district. First, it's important to recognize small, medium farms are part of the culture and tradition of this area. That may not be true with the large industrial farms out in the Midwest, the places where the $26 trillion to make up for the tariff deficits have all been going. They haven't been coming to people here, and farmers have been suffering terribly from it in all areas because of what you mentioned, the extreme weather events, because in dairy, for example, the drop in the price of milk that tanked in the 2014 and has been struggling ever since, and also because of immigration challenges, where we have a congressman who turned his back on immigration reform in 2013 instead of adopting it. It came down from Republican Rubio from the Senate, but they all turned their back for political purposes and theater instead of actually doing something that would have helped farmers here. And this is in all areas, fruit, vegetable, as well as dairy. The main things that I see would be, one, we can bring back programs that under the USDA we used to have in the past, buttermilk and cheese programs, extending certain kinds of credit under certain circumstances, We can also have mentorship programs that I think would be very useful. I'm sure there's got to be someone in Manhattan who would like to learn how to farm and change their life in that way. And we used to support those kinds of things. The second thing that we need to do is to have antitrust DOJ looking at some of the processors. The centralization of the processors is crushing the dairy industry. And I am sure that there's equivalent in areas of meat, may not be so much in fruit and vegetable, but it is a problem that needs to be addressed largely because of antiquated law from the 1930s that gave antitrust protection to so-called cooperatives, but are now acting in very rapacious ways towards producers. And are indeed part of the problem that we have when these dairy farms are going out of business and people are resorting to extreme measures such as suicide to correct the family finances. Mr. Reed has not said a single word on any of these points. I did debate him in 2018, and when I introduced a farmer who had made himself known to me and shared with me his challenges, Tom Reed's reaction was, "I'm sorry you lost your farm. It's just a market problem." It's much more than a market problem. It is the culture. It is the tradition. It is the livelihood. I never met, Hale, anyone who I thought had worked harder than my father owning a small business until I met a farmer, and really met a farmer. I mean, sat down at the kitchen table and talked to them and learned about their lives. And that, I believe, is why I now my heart is with farmers in this district, because it touches the part of me that remembers how hard my father worked. And we can make the changes that will make this better. We can support the local markets. We should be sure that food stamps can be used at local farmer markets. We can find ways around the pressure that the processors put on to be sure that we can enhance the wineries here in the Finger Lakes, the dairy farmers throughout the entire southern tier part of the district, the hospitality industry that really is just, you know, it's already been booming. It could boom more. So I could go on and on, but let me say this. I am in actual support of small and medium farmers in this district in every way that I can, from antitrust right on down to ways in which we can support local farming efforts. How about revitalizing the soil? Our campaign has put out a film, by the way. I invite people to go to the website, Matrano 2020, in about a week, and we will be making this film that we did about extreme weather events, organic growing culture, supporting small farmer markets. We just had a preview of it at Ravine Winery last night. It's been very well received. So I'm not just chit-chatting here. There's a genuine love and concern for what is our culture here in the Southern Tier, and I am in full support of it.
Thanks, Hal. Let me just ask, because I want to get to more phone calls. I'm going to try to ask a brief question. What is the earliest year you could see the United States essentially using close to nothing when it comes to fossil fuels?
Well, I believe the Biden plan has something marked off into 2050 where we can transition. I am for a transition, but I do want it to be orderly. I don't want to shut down a car or anything else, you know, while we're waiting for a renewable energy to be manufactured or properly researched to get the maximum ability out of a solar panel or, you know, what have you, the whole engineering and physics behind it. I understand it's 2050. Sometime around in there.
Okay.
Now, I work in technology, but I'm not a scientist, so I can't tell you that I know from research that that is correct. But I am for something, Evan, that puts us on a plan going forward, so we're not just taking it day by day and trying to figure it out.
All right, let me get Chris in Geneva next on the phone. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, I just wanted to compliment Ms. Matrano on being out here and being in throughout the district. Her opponent hides in little villages, from what I can tell. You can't keep up with him, and he uses the excuse that he's in Washington doing bipartisan work. But I've done some research, and I haven't been able to find any substantive bipartisan work produced by actually this problem solvers group. And I wondered if Ms. Matrano and her people have done any look for any substance to that claim, because he's not here. He's not around. You can't confront and talk to him. but Tracy's everywhere, and I really appreciate that.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Go ahead, Tracy.
Thank you, Chris. Well, the problem solvers have solved one problem of all the legislation that they push the press statements out on and do the political theater about, Chris. But it was nothing that will ever really touch your life. It was a small procedural thing that actually didn't need the problem solvers. It kind of was this annoying procedural thing about how you move a bill from committee onto the floor. There was some antiquated protocol that they tacked their name onto it when Congress overwhelmingly passed it, both Senate and House, in early 2019. Apart from that, it's goose egg. And I do mean goose egg. There's not a single bill that the Problem Solvers Caucus has brought around for the people of the United States or anything that's had any effect for the people of the United States. They may have good intentions, many of them, to be involved in it, but I am afraid it has become political theater and not a reality with any effect. How do you like how he does not advertise his town halls? And did you know that he gave his town halls that he doesn't advertise? The reason as to why he didn't want to debate me, and now is going to debate me on October the 27th, to which my answer was, why didn't he wait till November 4th? Military ballots went out 2 weeks ago. People have already told me through absentee they're voting, and early voting will already be 3 or 4 days in the mix. So this is par for the course of Mr. Reid. He ducks responsibility. He does not show up any place where people have real questions to ask him. And my question to you, Chris, is I'm going to be up in Geneva, which is only 15 minutes away from me here in Penn Yan, on Saturday night. Where's the best pizza?
We've lost Chris. That's a good question.
Oh, okay.
Chris, you better send the Metrano campaign a note on where to find the best pizza. I'm going to squeeze in Jane in Rochester on the phone. Got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Jane.
Okay. The question was asked, how did we get here? We were promised by Trump that we would get, with the tax cuts that you mentioned, we would get jobs and it would go to small businesses. Bullpucky. We didn't get it. What we Democrats need to be saying is things like, show me the jobs. And then another one might be, are you better off now than in 2016? That's as short as I can make it, Heaven.
Okay.
Thank you.
Jane, thank you. Go ahead, Tracy.
Thank you, Jane, and I appreciate your depiction of it all. I oppose very much the 2017 Tax Cut Act. You know, 1% of the people in this country own 40% of this country's wealth. We were great, to use another phrase, in the 20th century for maybe three reasons: our success militarily, which was built on a lot of development, including rural electrification, in the 30s and so forth, to make us ready for that victory in 45, Second World War, because we had labor unions that stabilized the political, social, and labor unrest from the turn of the last century, and because we had a progressive tax. Ever since the 1980s, we've had this smoke and mirrors about trickle-down economics, and I do not know how and why, except for the political corruption in Congress that keeps voting these tax acts and then creating enormous deficits. Minus the pandemic, we already have something nearing $2 trillion in deficit as a result of these tax cut acts. And let me tell you, this is how a politician smears the reality to the point where, to me, it sounds like a lie. How did Tom Reid come up with the number $1,600 for every middle-class person? That's what you're going to get back. Because he added vertically the tax cuts that the 1% got at an average of $69,000 instead of averaging horizontally along, say, a $75,000 or $100,000 income and then seeing the reality that came from that. This is the kind of trick, move the shell game around, that I believe the people of this country want to stop. And that's why I am going to Congress, to just get us back on track.
Hey, 30 seconds. Tom says your opponent has not filed a current financial disclosure form and recently filed for an extension. Do you know why? I'm not aware of that. Are you?
I am aware of that. I believe that he didn't file something until maybe August. And maybe what it was that he filed turns out to be an extension rather than the document itself. I don't know. He has been trying to play that same shell game that I was just talking about with Jane, with his own background with the medical debt collection business. In 2014, he turned it over to his wife. I called that the mafia approach. And then in 2019, he turned it over to his brother, which caused a big lawsuit between the two of them. His wife still gets a great big employment cut. So it may have something to do with that, Evan.
Tracy Matrano is a Democratic candidate in the 23rd Congressional District. Tom Reed is the Republican. We've invited both. We hope to have Tom Reed before the election in full. Tracy Matrano, briefly, what's your website so people can learn more about you?
Yes, sir, and thanks for having me. Matrano2020.com. Please help us out. Come join us and work with us. Volunteer, make calls, and if you can contribute money, we will use it wisely. Thank you so much.
Tracy Matrano, thank you for the time. And again, equal time offered to Tom Reed, and we hope to have the congressman on very soon. Short break, more connections coming up.